Hey, ding dongs! This is Jamie Cavanaugh.
This is Richard Lamb,
and this is Explain It to Jamie.
Woo!
Wing, 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 wing.
Zip, 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 zip. Yeah, we should have like a cool sound effect that we play.
Yes. Although I think it gets more and more like charming for us to keep making our own sound effects. Ding, ding, ding. Wop, 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 wop. This is a special episode of Explain It to Jamie because we have a friend.
That's
joining
right.
Us.
We have a friend. We made a friend finally.
Yeah,
Jamie
we
and I.
Willed him to into existence.
We've been friendless for 28 years, yeah. And finally, we made a friend.
He is the cooperative manifestation of our dreams.
That's right. And so, joining us today as our first ever guest is Mr. Hunter Cardinal.
Say hello, Hunter.
Hello. Hi.
Hunter is a friend of ours who's also a very skilled and talented artist. And who also happens to know a lot more about today's topic than even I do. So we thought it would be a great idea to have Hunter on to, you know, explain things to me and you at the same time, Jamie.
Yeah. That, I'm all for more integrated explanations.
Great. Yeah. So why don't we get into it?
Okay. I want to know this week, guys, about Standing Rock and all of the sort of politics around that.
Okay, so Jamie, why do you want to know about Standing Rock?
Well, you know, as is sort of becoming a like theme, it's something that pops up in my news feed a lot. A lot of people I know are energized and agitated around it, and are taking action themselves. And I don't feel like I know enough about it. I think I sort of know surface level stuff that's going on, like treaties are being trounced over in the name of the oil industry, and that's sort of the narrative I get, which I don't imagine to be untrue, but I think is a generalization. And so I want to know the ins and outs of what's going on, why everybody's so upset specifically, and possibly what we can do about it.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really simple topic, so this should be a really short one.
5-minute episode.
That's right. Perfect. It'll be like the water cycle, like learning about the water cycle in school. Did you ever do that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
We're watching Magic School Bus episode.
That's right. We're just going to play a Magic School Bus episode right now.
And Bill Nye. Bill Nye's coming back, guys.
Bill Nye.
He's starting a new show on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Like a rebirth of the Bill Nye show.
What's he going to talk about, though? Is it going to be like a gritty reboot?
I think.
Like a gritty Bill Nye reboot?
It is, actually.
Yeah, it's 5 o'clock shadow.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going to be like, all right, kids, today we're learning about fear.
Maybe.
It's going to be.
What I've seen, it looks like he got a way higher budget. Like, it looks like he's in like a literal spaceship while it's happening. Like, way bigger guests.
So he's going to do like a real life version of the Magic School Bus where they go inside somebody. Like, they're going to shrink Bill Nye and he's going in somebody.
It doesn't not present that vibe.
Yeah. All right. Well, keep an eye out for Bill Nye, the science guy, who also fucks now.
Bill Nye fucks now.
Does he have a love interest?
Bill Nye be fucking.
Okay, so Jamie.
Yes.
The Standing Rock issue.
Yeah.
Standing Rock is a they call them in America Native American, what we would call First Nations in Canada,
right.
Reservation in North Dakota.
Yes.
That belongs to a tribe called it's like the Lakota Sioux, I think is the Sioux is the name of the tribe. Mm-hmm. And they are right now protesting against an oil pipeline being built through a section of their land that's called the Dakota Access Pipeline. And this pipeline is supposed to take oil from the fracking fields of North Dakota to refineries that are in Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay,
basically, there's a number of issues at play here, which we're going to get into. There's the sort of immediate issues of the pipeline and then way larger issues about who gets to decide if and how a pipeline gets built, and what obligations do governments have to listen to, you know, again, they say Native American, I would say Indigenous people who are living on the land that has been promised to them by governments in North America. So, like, who gets to say what happens on a reserve? This is, like, a fundamental question of, like, North American geopolitics, right? So let's, do you want to start with, like, let's start with the immediate stuff that's happening right now. So what's interesting about Standing Rock is that for me, you know, often there have, since North American settlement from Europe became a thing, there's always been conflicts between the indigenous people here and the settlers who wanted to come and take all the land. Like that was just a fact of life. And rarely has there been such an obvious and blatant injustice as the Standing Rock situation. I think that's a huge part of why it has taken on the huge international prominence it has, is because it's so obviously, like, morally wrong what's happening there. So the and not that it wasn't in any of these other situations, it's just that this one, there's, like, almost completely indefensible that this pipeline is happening, and that because of that, everything else that's happened is, like, deeply horrifying and troubling. So, when the Dakota Access Pipeline was first being planned, originally it has to cross this river, right? From in North Dakota, in order to get to Illinois, it has to cross this river somewhere. And originally it was going to cross just north, upstream of the town of Bismarck, North Dakota, right? Which is, like, a very large city in North Dakota.
Yeah.
Or, like, comparatively, like, large city.
Yeah, I've been in Bismarck.
Right. Have you been to Bismarck?
I have.
Really? You actually have?
I actually have.
Oh, okay. I thought that was a joke, and I kept waiting for the punchline.
No, that was it.
What do you remember?
I went to Bismarck.
What do you remember about Bismarck?
It was Bismarck. I think there was a Montana's, which I found hilarious.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
Do you think that would be, like, stolen valor or something?
Yeah,
you know, like...
we did go to Montana's in Montana.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Which did was, you? Was there, like, a mirror version of yourself there, too? Like, it was like...
yeah, well, it felt like... it didn't represent Montana at all.
Yeah.
It's kind of like going to
North Dakota.
Sort of North Dakota.
Yeah. Okay. So the pipeline was originally supposed to run north of Bismarck, upstream of Bismarck.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got moved.
Right.
It got moved because they were worried that if there was a leak in the pipeline, it would contaminate the river, which is the drinking water supply for Bismarck. So because it posed a risk to the drinking water of Bismarck, the route for the pipeline got moved further downstream, upstream of this Indian reserve.
Right.
That's what they call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this was a pipeline that was moved where, because it posed the threat to the drinking water of a white city,
right,
it was moved to a place where it would only pose a threat to the drinking water of a reservation.
Right. So problem solved.
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, if you're the people building this pipeline, that is what you are thinking to yourself.
Yeah.
Right. So right away, there was not enough consultation on this. Right. That's one of the main things, is the Standing Rock Sioux feel that they didn't get a say and they're supposed to get a say.
Uh-huh.
And where the company has run into hot water is it has to cross the river. The place where it crosses the river now is part of the land that was granted to the Standing Rock Sioux in their original land treaty where this reserve was created, which I believe dates to 1850. So for the most part, the pipeline is on land owned by the federal government, but in this one spot where it crosses the river, it is land controlled by the Standing Rock Sioux, which means they're supposed to be able to have approval or not over the pipeline. They're supposed to be consulted in the building of this pipeline. They feel they were not adequately consulted, but then the pipeline started being built anyway. And they were, like, super insulted and horrified that this pipeline was being built because, A, they and many indigenous groups in North America have, like, a deep moral opposition to pipelines and to the expansion of the oil industry. And B, the whole point of this route being selected was that this pipeline does pose a danger to drinking water. And it was just that they were considered more expendable than the city of Bismarck, right?
Right.
So it came to the point where the pipeline was being built and the only option, or the option that the Sioux felt that they had to resist, was to physically blockade the further construction of the pipeline on their ground.
Right.
This is when the Sacred Stone Camp came into being, which is the camp on the reserve where protesters are staying, blocking a highway that's bringing construction and materials and things like that into where the pipeline is being built. And that's kind of the foundation of this entire issue. Hunter, am I all good on stuff so far?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So at its core, this is an issue about indigenous lives being worth less than white people's lives. Like, there's no other way to say it. And that fact that, like, in our culture, in all of our history as colonizers, we have considered indigenous lives to be worth less than settler lives. That's like a horrible fact of our past that haunts us to this day. It's still like, you can say all you want that people don't think like that anymore, but this is like a hard example of that not being true. This is a clear example of a major company valuing indigenous lives as being less important than like white lives.
Right. Okay. Great. So I hear the certain like blatant racism on like it's okay if we poison these people versus these people.
Right.
What kind of legal stand does the Standing Rock have, like based on like reservation rights and things like that?
Well, now we're really into it. Yeah. That's the million. That's the $7 billion question or whatever, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know too much specifically about the legalities of this pipeline, but what's really interesting for me is the more subtle institutional forms of almost racism and differences and almost paradigms of thought that go into allowing these pipelines to be built in the first place. So I won't pretend to know everything, and I'm not speaking for any one nation. My people are the Nahiao from Alberta. And I don't definitely speak for them, but one thing that's really interesting to note is how we view, some indigenous groups that I know of and that I feel like I could say, is how we relate to the land that we're on. And that is in major contrast with the, more Western view of how we relate to the world in more of a consumer context that goes really far back. Some scholars that I really dig kind of talk about the major differences is that Western thought has this idea that people are separate from nature, and that we can use nature as a means to an end to complete things. And this mode of thought was happening around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And we
is when most of the treaties were created and signed, like as a side note.
Yeah, this is ridiculously similar to like as resource extraction and using the land was starting to be more of a thing that the capitalist machine that was also just starting up as well. It was all happening around the same time, and we're still seeing effects today. So the major difference between the indigenous and non-indigenous view of the land is that we're a part of it and we're related to it.
Right. So in a lot of ways, what makes the legality thing such a hard question is that indigenous cultures fundamentally operate by different rules, right? And if you recognize the culture as being a sovereign entity that has the right to decide whether or not something is permissible on their land, you have to also validate and respect in the like sense of honoring what they choose or don't choose, that the fact that they believe different things about what is valid and legal and good than Western North American culture does.
Yeah.
Yes? Question mark?
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's totally it. I think there's one quote that I think really stands out in this instance. This is
shit. Hunter's got quotes.
This is from Glenn Coulthard, his Subjects of the Empire essay that he wrote. It's a quick quote. I think he's actually quoting someone in this that I'm going to be reading.
So hey, quote and a quote.
So this quote is from Glenn, quoting a guy named Alfred Tayage. He's a great scholar. Both are great scholars. But the quote is, "The heart and soul of indigenous nations, a set of values that challenge the homogenizing force of Western liberalism and the free market capitalism, that honor the autonomy of the individual conscious, non-coercive authority, and the deep connection between human beings and other elements of creation." So for me, what this is talking about is there's an inherent conflicting view view and paradigm between Western consumerism and capitalism and indigenous values of community-based obligations and what you as a person are obligated to do for everyone that's around you, the world that you come from, and the people that will be there in the future and the ones that have already come from the past.
It's also worth saying that these treaties, which mostly were signed and worded in the 19th century, were, like, I've looked at a couple of the text of a couple of them now, and mostly they say, they basically just say, like, we make a deal with, the one for Toronto I looked at today, it says, like, we, the Crown, make a deal with the Mississaugas and the New Credit of this area for the territory that's east of the Etobicoke River. And it's like kind of a funny old school thing that it's like, it's the territory east of the Etobicoke River to this specific tree. It has 12 branches. It's this high. Like, it's like, that's like the landmark they use. Right. And then they're like, and we cede that to the country, the province of Canada, and the Mississaugas and New Credits get to keep fishing rights on this part of the ocean. And that's all it says, right? It's just like, we give up this part, you get this part, you get to keep, like, and so a lot of the times the actual rights are vague on after that, right? Like, the written agreement is vague, but in history, the kind of European people who are making these treaties use them very cynically. Like, they would, and because indigenous cultures did lots of their negotiating and agreeing orally, right? They spoken agreements were what, and also like exchange of items like wampum belts and things like that were what formalized an agreement in indigenous culture, right? But contracts were what formalized an agreement in European culture. Often there was all kinds of back dealing bullshit where European people would say one thing and then write another thing on the paper, everyone would sign it, they would agree, and then the European people would be like, no, it's what it says on the paper, gotcha, you know, like, that happened, absolutely, that kind of, like, double-crossing happened all the time. And there was a landmark case in Canada in the 1990s that said that when enforcing and dealing with these treaties, the government had an obligation to try to enforce them in the way that they were meant, like the spirit of what they meant, as opposed to the letter, mm-hmm. right? But because of that, there's a huge gray area about what that means, you know, because you're relying on what was promised to people verbally in the 19th century versus what this piece of paper says. So it's never stabilized. Like, there's no hard and fast rule about what kind of sovereignty in the Western sense these tribes, these bands have over their reserve land. It kind of it's very case by case, and it's legally really icky. It's like a gray area.
Right. Yeah. Right. So there's lots of room for interpretation based on what you want to happen.
Exactly.
And okay. And I imagine, as oil companies seem to always have, they've got lots of lawyers to help interpret that.
They have
in the way,
nothing but lawyers. I actually think oil companies like form when five lawyers stand in the same room.
It's what?
It's how oil companies are formed. They're like, you know how moss always grows on like the north side of a tree or whatever? It's like, oh, there's six lawyers here? Like, boom, you're an oil company. It's like this deed of incorporation just fell out of me.
Yeah. So, okay. And okay. This kind of topic's always hard.
Yeah.
But so,
I would say don't be afraid to say something bluntly and indelicately, because we know that you're like,
well, no, it's just, yeah. I'd say it's just like frustrating how obviously like morally correct one side of the argument is.
That is what's fucking frustrating.
You know what I mean? It's
this.
Like, it's hard for me to think of questions to sort of like even out the teeter totter a little bit.
But that's just like, Jamie, this is the thing about this issue that's so crazy, is that there is no fair and balanced perspective on Standing Rock.
Yeah.
This is a case of an oil company ruthlessly endangering people for profit.
Right.
There is no alternative explanation for this. And okay, we'll get in, like, let's advance the timeline a little bit now. Like, in the months where the protests at Standing Rock happened, militarized police, like, you know how militarization of the police is a huge issue in America. For those who haven't heard of it, what it means is the police are increasingly arming themselves and equipping themselves and training and mobilizing like militaries. Right now, police have armored cars, they have machine guns, they have full body armor, they have helicopters, they have all these things that you don't need to issue people traffic tickets, right?
Yeah.
Militarized police have arrived from neighboring states and employed insanely brutal methods of crowd control on the Standing Rock protesters, who have been nonviolent and peaceful, as far as I know, 99.9% of the time. I think there's like, they've burned a few vehicles that had nobody in them that belonged to the oil company who was building the pipeline, but they haven't hurt anybody. Whereas the protesters have had attack dogs used against them. They've had concussion grenades and tear gas used against them. They were being sprayed with water cannons in below freezing weather, which is lethal force. And a protester, like a young woman, lost an arm after she was hit with a water cannon.
Yeah, I know a friend of mine who headed down there and found herself in a North Dakota jail for a couple weeks.
Tons of people arrested and held in mass arrests. Many people, and then also there's like legal and legislative injustice too. Like, for example, for a long time they tried to make it so that if there was no lawyers available, because all the public defenders in North Dakota were overwhelmed by how many people had been arrested. It's about 700. It's upwards of 700 people since this all started to heat up in the summer.
Right.
And that's way more people than North Dakota's equipped to deal with defending, like, for free, you know, if you get a public defender in America. So there were people going to trial with no lawyers until there was a motion introduced that defenders could come in from out of state. Right. But until that point, like, people were going to have to go to trial without a lawyer to defend themselves.
Right.
They also, the gremlins in the North Dakota legislature, which is Republican, passed a bill that makes it legal for you to hit someone with your car if they're blocking a roadway if you say it was an accident, which is thought to be aimed at protesters, because protesters often block roads in America. It's like one of the only really effective ways of disruption that they have. And so in North Dakota, they made a bill that you can hit someone with your car if they're blocking a roadway if it's not on purpose.
Mm.
Not on purpose. I'm doing air quotes right now.
Wow. And so, okay, Hunter, I know your dad went down to Standing
Rock,
didn't he?
Both my dad and my sister went. My sister went on behalf of the media company that her and I started up last year called Nehewin, where we try to incorporate indigenous governance systems into the creation of digital media. My dad went on behalf of the Parliament of World Religions, and they were both there on the day that they got the notification that the Army Corps would block any type of construction of the pipeline.
That's right. So this was the day that Barack Obama basically halted construction of the pipeline. This was one of the last things he did of substance in office.
Yeah.
December. Right. That would have been December.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if we wanted to quickly touch on the other side of the story, and you were kind of mentioning like there's one moral side that's like pretty spot on and the other side's kind of murky. I think it has to go back to this, once again, perspective and this paradigm of thought that I think is very pervasive throughout all of Western society. And it's this idea of if you're not using the land to create something of value, and then that value is like a
product, like a commodity.
If it's not a commodity that's being used to do a thing that we all value, then you're not using it right. You're not doing it right. Let us help you. So it's this weird sense of paternalism, and then also like this weird idea of like, We see that you guys aren't doing anything like how we would do it, therefore you guys aren't using it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important thing to look at, because that once again illuminates this idea of like there are indigenous governance systems and ways of relating to the world and each other that have existed for thousands of years that is being actively dismissed because it doesn't fit an understanding of governance, of being productive, that most Western societies have.
Right. What's so interesting about it is that it's a fight over a pipeline that is actually a fight about different worldviews, like fundamentally, and which worldviews recognize each other and which are allowed space and sovereignty.
Mm. Yeah. Like, I was sort of, me and Richard were talking a bit earlier about, we were talking about Keystone Pipeline, which is different, but it's, I was reading about that today and about what, you know, where it started, whether it's likely to go through. Now see, like you know, Donald Trump wants to push it through, and in doing that, I got into like looking at TransCanada Corp stocks, and okay, well, what if it's gonna go through? What, like, wouldn't it? Doesn't it make sense for me to
invest money in it. Yeah, it's bad for the environment, but it's better that it's going to like a lefty liberal like me than you know, someone who's big and evil and awful and running a company. So I was like looking at these stocks, wondering how much I could buy, what the dividends are, stuff like that. And I realized that like in buying these stocks, although completely legal, completely like fiscally responsible, I am investing myself in a morality issue that I don't feel comfortable standing on the other side of. Now, this was earlier today what I was going through, and I'm like, I don't agree with using non-reusable resources. I don't agree with potentially poisoning people's water. I don't. But my thought was, in the moment, it's going to happen anyway, I might as well make some money. And I realized, like, that's the bias. Like, that's the...
That's like the ghost of neoliberalism whispering in your ear.
Yeah, exactly. That's what evil in capitalism looks like. You know what I mean? Yeah. It doesn't... It's not the, like, six men in suits smoking cigars in the penthouse of a New York office building saying, man, like, how are we going to fuck everybody's day up? Yeah. It's through everybody's brain of just, oh, this is the way our system works. It's going to happen anyway. I might as well get a piece of the action as it goes by.
The notion in your head that you understand that you should be opposed, and in your heart you are opposed to something political or an issue, but that it is like too large for you to change or affect on your own, is the disease of neoliberalism in our modern culture. It's the voice in our heads that says we're not political actors. Like, we have moral opinions, but we have no moral obligations to action in our contemporary culture. That's like a weird development of the last 20 years, and I think it's one that I really hope it starts changing and reversing, because like we've all had those moments. I personally came super late to understand to fully resisting the expansion of the oil industry in Canada and elsewhere. I for a long time thought it was a necessary evil, but I slowly but surely have come to see that it is not literally, I mean, it's the buzzword, right? It's not a sustainable way for us to live our lives, and we need to transition away from that as quick as possible.
Well, and it's all like economics of what you invest in, whether you're investing money, time, interest, whatever you like.
Yeah.
You know, I equate it to, it's the same thing that makes Albertans like love oil, mm-hmm. is the same thing that makes little kids love Sony PlayStation versus Nintendo 64.
Yeah, man.
You know what I mean? Like, when I was in elementary even, I used to get in arguments with my friends about what was better, Sony PlayStation or N64, and I would always argue Sony PlayStation was better, and some of them would argue N64 was better. And the reason that each of us were arguing that point is because I had a Sony PlayStation and they had an N64.
Yeah.
So like, I'm invested in Sony PlayStation being better because I have one.
Throwing it all the way back to my boy Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, author of The Little Prince, it is the time you have spent on your rose that makes it yours, that makes it different than all the other roses. If I wrote a Little Prince adaptation where a young boy learns to love the physical manifestation of oil by like hanging out with it, Enbridge would give me so much money.
yeah and Alberta, right? Has put a lot of time and money into their rose that happens to make the surface of the earth look like the surface of the moon,
right?
And like poison people's water, and like, you know, so there's for me, and I'm an Alberta boy, it's like I despise the oil industry, mm-hmm. and yet I look around me in my home and go like, but I get it. Mm-hmm. I understand why there's this push. I understand there's all these people who are good people who depend on this resource.
Well, and I think you should have that human compassion. Like, I think that you should understand that these people have built their lives, even though it is... they're misguided about the impact of what they're doing, and I think many times deliberately blind to the extremely serious consequences we're all having. I understand that your life is built on a certain thing, and you are resistant to change. I think the people who they should be angry at are the conservative Alberta provincial government, who never diversified their economy and who have made them bet everything on oil, and because of that it's like oil or nothing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the, and therein is the evil, right?
Right.
When I am invested in something, when I am biased towards something, I'm willing to put a blindfold on
to mm-hmm. potentially shitty stuff to benefit from the thing that I've already spent all this time and money on.
Yeah.
And that seems to be like, you know, just this sort of weird little Keystone stock moment I had today sort of shook my world a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awful. And it's frustrating because it's so morally wrong what's happening at Standing Rock.
Yeah.
And yet I can understand the sort of cold, like, not with regard to the racism and moving the pipeline, but I can understand the cold, like, logical need for an oil person to make it work.
Well,
you know what I mean?
In a lot of ways, our entire culture is based on offloading all of our problems onto other countries of full of people that we don't see, hear from, and can pretend don't exist, right? Like, if in North America, we can offload our famines onto other people, right? We get food brought to us from all over the world, right? Mm-hmm. It's other people who have food shortages, but not us. And I think that what makes Standing Rock so shocking is that it is not ignorable. Mm-hmm. It's happening here. And it is that cold logic of our modern capitalism, which happens all the time all around us, but it's right in our faces. And when it's so clearly out in the daylight, you can't pretend it's something other than what it is. I think that's why Standing Rock has been such a flashpoint.
Yeah.
And why it will be a very crucial fight for us in the years ahead.
Yeah. Also, I just want to make sure that I'm clear. I'm not for any of this.
We both are. Tondra and I both bought a shitlot of fucking Trans Canada stuff.
We're gonna buy a PlayStation and an N64.
Yeah, fucking Jamie, right. Trying to learn shit. Yeah.
Goon. Peon.
You dumb. Learn all you can and invest your money accordingly.
That's right.
I want to be clear that, like, I'm just trying to dissect the mindset that goes into building a pipeline like that. You know what I mean? Like, what is the impetus? And I have such a hard time, you know, whenever someone's like, oh, it's just evil. You know, it's evil. It's a, you know, a dark magical concept.
Drugs. Oil is like drugs.
Yeah. And Alberta is addicted to oil.
Absolutely. We're all addicted to oil.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah,
if you look at the earth as like, if the earth was a single organism, like the debate right now playing out over the oil industry in the world is like, each of us are like a voice in the earth's conscious, like the voices that want the drug and the voices that, like, that kind of know you should get off it. You know, like, it's like, I don't know. That's a weird metaphor to use, but
no, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I think there's an interesting thing that's happening right now. And like, these questions that you're asking, are questions that I find myself, and I've talked to my sister loads about, is how do we transition from a place of this dependency on oil products, neoliberalism, mm-hmm. all these things that, you know, are inherently conflicting with, you know, values that I've been told are at the center of Indigenous governance.
Mm. I think the values that a lot of us, I mean, many of us were given, at least what we were told our values were, also conflict with those values. You know, the value that you should share things, that you should be kind to people, you should look out for other people, that you should be charitable and empathetic. Like, even though those are kind of soft values, like, they are at odds with the way our oil industry behaves. I think, and for me, I always come at it, it's growth. Like, our culture, our number one value, if not our number one value, is growth. It's like, if you do something, how are you going to grow it? How is it going to get bigger? How are you going to get more of that? If you start a business, how are you going to get it? If you release a CD, if you're a musician, how are you going to sell more copies? How are you going to play bigger things?
How are you going to get more views on your podcast?
Exactly. How are you going to get more views on your podcast? Our answer was, we bought Russian sex bots who are all listening to the podcast constantly.
Yeah.
But other than that one example,
it's weird that there were sex bots. We paid.
They could have
extra.
Been just normal bots. I paid way more for the sex bots.
I wanted them to have specific sex functionality.
Yeah, I made my first friend only this week, so, you know.
And that's one of the most interesting things about this topic that has been brought up today was the difference in worldview between the oil companies and the tribes that stand in its way.
And this is, I think, at least how I see it, as the fundamental conflict point is that there's a culture that values growth above everything versus a culture that does not. That does not value growth as a primary value. And this is a serious point of conflict.
Yeah. And I can see that that is also present within a lot of indigenous discourse right now. It's this idea of, and there's a bunch of scholars that are talking about it now, but this idea of the politics of recognition. And that's like a, and I'm going to give a really bad summary of it. And
that's like it, this podcast's entire existence.
Here we go. But it's basically this idea of how can we all have a seat at the table when really that idea, that dependency and that need to be recognized at the table is totally manufactured. It has no relevance. And it's not actually true with your own values that you hold. So that's what I see with, which is happening a lot with a lot of Aboriginal leaders running into the values that they come from. It's this way of being like, you know, we gotta take control of the master's tools so that we can be using them to basically now we're the master that's slowly like assimilating into this bigger machine. And it's a really tough question because how do we then break that cycle while we're still in the thing? How do we reclaim the tools that we used to have and build the things that we used to make, especially given that we're in an entirely different context? And I think it's really important to note, too, that, you know, indigenous societies didn't exist in this like idyllic past of not touching the environment and living like high-fiving deers on their way to hanging out with the chipmunks.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there was massive use of the land that got basically totally destroyed once the nations that were tending those ecosystems were also destroyed and assimilated due to a lot of things that are still happening today.
But at the same time, I mean, like, in a way, that's why I kind of like my framing of it, is because even though they were using the land, there was growth of those societies and they were competing for resources and for power and influence and all those things. Growth was not their primary value. You know what I mean? There were other values that were as important as growth, and those had a spot at the table, as you said.
And one of those things that's popping up now is instead of a rights-based discourse of how do we get rights, how do we get rights as indigenous people in this bubble of Western neoliberalism, consumerism, blah, blah, blah. But what's coming up now is what are our obligations as indigenous people to our communities that we come from? So it's something that I think is called community-based obligations. And when you start asking the question of what is my obligation as a dope person to my friends, that changes it. That changes it. And if companies started asking that, or the next level of people started asking that who have agency, I think you would see a lot more change. And I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind, too.
That is so interesting. The idea of like, if you can't beat them, join them and like beat them at their own game. But then in doing that, what do you sell off of yourself and the people you dedicated yourself to? Very similar to what I was saying earlier about as a liberal guy who's against fossil fuels, about investing in the industry.
I can make some money. If you can't beat them, join them. I can make some money. I could use it for good things, right?
For good things, use it for my play production, whatever it is. You know what I mean? And so, it's the exact same thing.
It's a slippery slope, though.
As soon as you cross that threshold, you are agreeing to rules. And as soon as you agree to rules, you put yourself at risk of losing the rules that you choose to represent.
Yeah. I didn't touch on this in the clarification episode, but I had thought about it. Jamie asked me in the first episode about Vladimir Putin why so many communist countries became like totalitarian dictatorships. I actually didn't really get that answer right. I sort of did, but not really. So, I mean, I'll clarify it now, is that there was a concept for a long time among the first communist movements, the early communist movements of the 20th century, that there needed to be this middle step between the old system, whether it be industrial capitalism or like feudalism in Russia is what they revolted against. There needed to be this middle step where the end game was there would be no leadership structures. It would be like a kind of communist utopia, right? Like this all comes from Marx, Karl Marx. Marx was a utopian. He wasn't a dry academic thinker. He was like a dreamer, right? And so what's crazy is so much of the history of the 20th century was like this dreamer dudes, people trying to put this like real dreamer's vision into reality and what that looked like. Mm. And Marx wrote this thing where he said there needed to be first a dictatorship of the proletariat where the workers would rise up and then like command society. But he used the word dictatorship of the term, dictatorship of the proletariat. And that's why so many communist countries became totalitarian is the first thing they did was establish a dictatorship. At first it was like a party dictatorship, right. But then it was susceptible to being taken over by right. a single person because the mechanisms of control existed already.
Like Caesar in ancient Rome.
That's right. It's yeah. like they set up a system where they could control everything and then one dude took it over.
Right.
Right. I mean, and what's interesting now is that many models of socialism have moved away from the idea that there needs to be a dictatorship and instead are looking to democratic structures right. as like the middle ground step.
Mm-hmm. It's also basically what happened to Saruman in Lord of the Rings.
Yes, that's
and right. and then you look at the effects of that had on the Shire. And,
yeah.
Yeah. I won't spoil it. Yeah. It's hot off the presses.
Oh, man, the scene in the Two Towers where Trotsky touches the like the Palantir and it's like the eyes looking at him and it's like he will be killed in Argentina by an ice pick.
It's the things are there.
Or is it in Mexico?
Was
it Mexico?
Maybe.
Trotsky was killed in Rivendell, right?
He was stabbed in the back by Wu Tung at the top of the...
Yeah, it was like a ring wraith. It was like, Stalin says hi, bitch! Yeah. So should we catch up to the present day where we're at Standing Rock?
Yeah, okay. So, Mr. Trump
is
now mobilizing on what?
Yeah, so
on what Barack Obama stopped.
So Barack Obama had the authority to stop the Army Corps of Engineers, a division of the Army who does construction and stuff.
Mm.
They were overseeing the construction on government land. And Barack Obama had the authority, because they're a federal organization, to order them to do stuff. So he ordered them to stop building the pipeline in December.
Right.
Donald Trump reversed that order last week. So the pipeline has continued to be built.
Okay.
There have been a lot of the Standing Rock Sioux are using a lot of different legal challenges and protest methods at the same time to try to get any foothold they can. They've won a couple victories and also had a lot of losses. Like they tried to get them to stop drilling because of the environmental impact of the pipeline, but the judge said, drilling's not what you're worried about. You're worried about the oil flowing through the pipeline. So no, this isn't a valid legal challenge, right?
Right.
The drilling was allowed to continue. So that's where we're at today.
And it's, is it tar sand?
Or
is
no, it, it's fracking oil.
Fracking oil.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is also, I mean, let's sideline here. Like fracking is a really not well understood it's not really well understood what the long-term effects of fracking are going to be on the environment because it's such a new technology.
Right.
And Donald Trump really wants to deregulate the oil industry and fracking, like the regulations on the fracking industry are so important to it because a huge...
Well, fracking is like, that's dirty oil, isn't it? Like,
yeah, I mean...
It costs a lot environmentally just to produce.
Here's what fracking is. Like it's shale oil. So it's oil that's a part of these rocks. Like it's like oil and shale rocks mixed in together. And what they do is they drill a huge hole and then a sideways hole into the shale deposit. They pump it full of these crazy chemicals, which like cause all these tiny cracks to go into the shale oil and then like clean it out, separate the oil from the water and all the other shit, dissolve the rocks and stuff like that. And then they suck all the chemicals out, suck the oil out, and then they dump the chemicals, dig a well, and dump the chemicals in a deep well far under the earth somewhere else. Now, the issues with shale, with this, are the chemicals they use are so strong that even a water treatment plant can't get them out of your water. They're super poisonous and toxic, and they're designed to burrow through rocks. So even though the way they contain them is they dig a super deep hole and leave them in the ground once they've been used, they seep out of that because they're made to seep out of the ground, right?
Right.
And so there have to be really important key regulations about where they're put and how much goes in and all these kinds of things.
Right.
Like what if they reach a city's water supply? What if they burrow to a city's water supply? That, like, water sources have been contaminated by fracking. Right. And this is why fracking is so expensive. You have to do all these extra steps. It's not just like a bunch of, it's not like There Will Be Blood, you know, where it's like one, like, gritty dude with a mustache can, like, pickaxe really hard for a single montage and right. then, like, oil spurts all over him, right? Like, it's not like that at all anymore.
Right, right. You know, you have to manipulate the environment yeah. to give you the oil.
And we're looking at an administration where Donald Trump wants to put less regulations on the oil industry, and this pipeline is an expansion of the fracking industry. It will mean more fracking in North Dakota. That's the kind of oil they have in North Dakota, fracking, right?
Right, yeah. Right, right. Oh, God. Okay. Yeah. Well, fine, great. And how big... the fracking industry in the States is huge now, right?
Like, yeah, there's over a million fracking sites.
Fracking's pretty new.
Yeah, there's been over a million fracking sites. It's by far the newest boom of oil. Like, it really it enlarged the possible amount of oil we could use on Earth by a lot when they discovered fracking. It was, right.
Yeah. Oh, God. And that's like, you know, when we say dirty oil, you know,
we mean the stuff that I buy. We mean the stuff that I buy at the sex shop that I use. That I use when I'm at very special times of night when I'm alone.
You're thinking about dirty. You're thinking about dirty oil with two R's.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what the follower bot Svetlana was telling me to buy the other day. Yeah. She wanted me to click a link.
Yeah. So dirty oil, for those of you that don't know, is like oil that costs. Not like, obviously using fossil fuels is bad for the environment, but dirty oil is. A mining of fossil fuels in a way that is awful for the environment.
That also expands like, tons of fossil fuels in order to get them out.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's like putting in three quarters of a cup of water and expecting to take out fucking, what's it like? It's like...
Yeah, what are you getting at? Take us through
through. It's like, it's like... Putting in 100 units of fossil fuels for 125 units.
That's correct.
Of fossil fuels. It's like you're getting back just barely above what you spend, but there's massive stores of it.
And so. Somebody's making billions of dollars.
I mean, yeah, what we were saying. Keystone Pipeline is set to send 500,000 barrels of oil from to arrive in the Gulf of Mexico every day.
For those who don't know, Keystone goes from the tar sands in Alberta all the way to the Gulf Coast, the Gulf of Mexico coast, the Gulf Coast of Florida.
Oh yeah, yeah, like something like 2,300.
That's very long
miles or something like that.
It's also worth saying, like, sometimes it can seem, certainly before I really looked into it, it can seem like when. The whole issue is that the pipeline might spill in the river, right? Which may seem like kind of an abstract danger. Pipelines spill all the time, like more than you even think they do. Since 2010, there have been like 3,300 pipeline spills. And in fact, there was a pipeline spill in Saskatchewan like 2 months ago. And the last pipeline, there was another pipeline spill in Saskatchewan like 6 months before that. And sometimes they're just like a small spill, but they leak. It happens a lot. So the idea that this pipeline would spill in the river is like, it's not a small chance.
Well,
it's like
a bunch
danger.
Of spills that were happening with the North Dakota Access Pipeline that was happening, right?
Seriously?
Yeah, there's like bunch that they didn't even. This sounds like I'm just gossiping.
Yeah.
There was a bunch of spills that happened that weren't documented and released to the public.
What do you mean? Why would the oil company ever not release information about spills to the public?
That doesn't sound right to me.
That doesn't sound like them. Mm-hmm. They sound like okay guys.
Wow. Okay. Great. Great.
How are you feeling, Jamie? How's your head?
We're getting to that point where I wish I knew less.
Hey, so. That means we probably did a good job. Okay, is it summary time?
Time for a bit of a summary.
Okay, so what did you learn, Jamie?
So there's the Dakota Access Pipeline,
yeah.
Which goes from North Dakota to Illinois.
Correct.
And it is meant to cross through reserve land by the Sioux Band.
Yeah.
And the reason it's there... is because they didn't want it to go too close to Bismarck, North Dakota, for fear of poisoning white people. So the Sioux tribe and others, I imagine, in and around Standing Rock, have blockaded
the oil company from building its pipe on their land, and thus is Standing Rock. It was met by victory when President Obama made an executive order to stop its construction. However, now that we have Lord Voldemort running the United States, he has very nicely undid that order, and they are regaining momentum on that project. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and so I imagine more protests are on the way.
One of the things that happened last year with the pipeline was there's a group of army veterans who came and like helped protests.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they're back now this weekend. And actually now the police have started to do stuff like arrest people before they even get to the camp if they're heading there with like camping gear and stuff. Or if you say you're going there, they'll just arrest you.
Right. Also to continue on my summation. So there's an obvious moral issue. The legal issue is less clear because the stuff that was like the treaties that were signed are, you know, a century and a half old and are kind like beautifully unspecific and vague, and so are open to interpretation or at the very least like loopholing from like contemporary lawyers, which the oil company has lots and lots of money for. And also one of the big things that I'm going to leave this with is the idea of, which is, it's strange, it seems kind of clear and obvious, but it's not. But at least something clicked for me in this one, was the idea that this is an argument of worldview between like neoliberal capitalists and First Nations tribes, and the way they view the world and the way they view the way things should work for harmony and for progress. And that's, you know, the idea that in order to change the game, First Nations people are having to join the game, which is obviously hugely conflicting in values. And that's what I've
nice, man. Taken. Yeah, I mean, it's a really upsetting case because like the cops are defending an oil company against Americans, right? Like, there's no other way to say it. That's the clearest way to say it. The armed wing of the state is defending the right for a massive multi-billion-dollar company to endanger people against the desires of the people who are affected, right? It's the first serious, incursion between the state and the people in America under Trump's rule. I mean, there was, like, the airport thing, but the Sandy Rock has been in the works for a long time. It started under Obama and it's continuing under Trump. And the tactics, the brutal, violent tactics being used by police against people who are literally just trying to not be poisoned it's so clear how immoral it is, I think, to anybody who puts their head around it.
Right. Which is probably why it's garnered so much attention. Exactly. And so much support.
Yeah. Hunter, am I missing anything? You got anything? Any wrap-up thoughts?
No. Well, it just, for me, when you start like messing around with like waterways and water systems, it's like, I'm not a specialist in that field, but I feel like that's pretty dangerous, and that just affects more than just people on a reserve, but like it could affect a lot more people. So it's more so a question of human rights, and it's very complex, so I am definitely more reading into it for sure. Yeah.
Everyone should keep their eyes peeled too. I mean, with the Keystone XL pipeline restarting now, I'm sure there are going to be flashpoints in Canada and the United States where this pipeline is protested. Also in Ontario, the Chippewas of the Thames have a Supreme Court case right now where they're fighting the enlargement and the flow reversal of a pipeline that already runs across their territory. They're saying they weren't consulted on that. Again, it's a similar issue. Not enough consultation, no respect of their sovereignty and their wishes, their worldview. That course was presented at the Supreme Court a month ago, but it hasn't been decided yet. So that's one to watch out for as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, I know, obviously, I was reading about pipelines today, but the Keystone Pipeline
passes over the, what's it called? Omijawa, Omijaja, something. It's got a
Star Wars thing.
Wherever, you know, Jabba the Hutt, where he was born.
Yeah,
the aquifer that was.
Omijawa.
Passes over the Omijawa.
But it's an immense aquifer right in the center of the United States, one of the biggest aquifers on the planet that many, many cities rely on for water. It takes up almost a third of the country, this aquifer, and the pipeline passes directly over it. So, you know, that's not just one group of people's water. That's a massive, massive amount of coverage. I was shocked by. I mean, you know, poisoning any number of people, I think, is fucking awful. But it just seems to me so clearly morally wrong. And
that's what's funny about it. It's like a moral issue that is so entrenched with economics.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, like in so many ways, it reminds me of what the debate about slavery used to be like. And I know that people are already freaking out that I said that, but like the way that morals and economics are tied together, it's like exactly the same thing. And people use a lot of the same arguments to defend the oil industry that they used to defend slavery, which should make you think twice.
There's a concept called colonial doublespeak and also the shape-shifting colonial power, where it basically challenges this notion that colonialism in like any sense was something that it happened in the past and that doesn't exist anymore, and we've moved past that and look how progressive we are. But then when you start examining, you know, what's happening with the oil companies, with neoliberalism, and how like how many tentacles it has in everyone's life, and then you start, you know, realizing how embedded you are in that system, it really makes you think and makes you realize how much work needs to be done and how much respect needs to be paid.
Yeah, well, I think I sort of go back to my old point of just checking your bias. You know, the idea that, and this isn't my idea, this is something, but like the idea that everybody is a little bit, everybody's biased, everybody is a little bit racist, everybody is a little bit homophobic, everybody's a little bit of everything, because that's the system you were raised in. And the measure of how much you grow is the measure of how much you're able to identify the biases that you were entrenched with and to let those go. Like, so, you know, there's always room to improve. I'm speaking more specifically about, knowing whether you own a Sony PlayStation. Why are you fighting for Sony PlayStation?
Yeah.
Why is it important to you that Sony PlayStation is the best system? Because I own one. And you're like, oh yeah, okay, is it actually, or am I just tricking myself into thinking that, you know, I'm invested? Yeah, oil's good. Why? Because my town runs on oil, and because the prosperity of my family depends on oil. Oh wait a second, I'm addicted, you know, I'm biased in this way. Well, I feel this way about this certain kind of person. Why? Oh, because this is the way my grandmother talked around me, or whatever it is. You know what I mean?
And there's another whole episode in how people construct their identities and how capitalism like exploits that, you know?
Yeah.
I got to go put on my Adidas, my full body Adidas tracksuit now and listen to my iPod
TM.
Yeah.
Don't forget to Instagram about it.
I will Instagram about it for sure. You know, build your brand. Hashtag build your brand, y'all.
Hashtag best. Hashtag love.
Yeah. Hashtag Richard's best. Brand is made of other brands.
I'm a brand mosaic.
Yeah.
Aren't we all?
We all
just
are.
Made up of the brands buy the shit of and wear on our bodies.
That's right, man. That's how you can tell who's rich and who's not.
Yeah. Oh God. Okay. You feel like you learned something today, Jamie?
Yeah. I definitely did. Definitely did. This one I feel like really more so than taught me facts, because I feel like I was pretty well versed with the facts. More so taught me perspective, which is great.
Yeah.
Very can be just as valuable.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hunter, thanks a lot for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for being my friend.
Hey,
thanks for being our friend.
Yeah.
Our first friend. Yahoo.
Ooh.
If you like this episode, please, please, please share it with your friends. Like it. If you do us a favor, hop on iTunes, give us a rating. That helps us.
in a big way. And keep listening above all, because we're only getting started. Thank you so much to Hunter for joining us. I've been Jamie.
I've been Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie.